The work of this church in the world is realized through the generous financial support of all who call this place home. Along with the gifts and time and talent, ours is a shared ministry. You have a role to play here. Church membership is open to all. For more information, go to uusf.org.
As today's service is about looking back to our history as we imagine new possibilities for the future, how moving to begin with the words of an obituary of someone who lived such a powerful life. I once heard someone say that some of us are trying to live lives that will make for a good resume, and some of us are trying to live lives that will make for a good eulogy. And on this anniversary of the Voting Rights Act, as our country is still wrestling with who gets to vote and whose voice matters, in this time of unpredictable and dramatic headlines, there is a question beneath so many of these debates, a question of how will we care for each other? And when I think of care, I often think of healthcare, because one of the most basic answers to this question, one of the most practical, is that when we are hurt, when we are injured, when we find ourselves in an emergency, we call for an ambulance. Let me tell you a little bit about ambulances. I grew up in a world where ambulances are something to be taken for granted. But paramedics, friends, have not been around as long as I, at least, had imagined. Before there were paramedics, it wasn't always clear whose job it was to rush someone to the hospital when they were injured. Before we had the system we have now, well, there was no system. Sometimes it was the firefighters who would pick people up. In some places, it was the local funeral home, which, I'm going to be honest, I don't love that. I can just picture having some horrible accident in my home and hearing someone in my housemate family yell out, "Quick, Matt's down. Someone call the funeral home." No, thank you. More often than not, though, it was the police who dealt with medical emergencies. The problem, though, is that neither the police nor the firefighters, and certainly not the funeral homes, had any medical training beyond the most basic first aid. So their only job was to get people to the hospital as fast as they could so the real treatment could then begin. This was an ongoing health disaster in our nation. It was a problem because people were injured and they weren't getting real medical care, and particularly in communities of color where the police were the ones responsible bringing them to the hospital, it was often those same police who were ignoring or often harassing folks in African American neighborhoods in particular. Not all cities were founded by abolitionists. So this problem came to a boiling point in the 60s. The federal government published a report about all of this, saying that as many as 50,000 deaths a year were the result of a lack of pre-medical care. The report noted that you were more likely to survive being shot in Vietnam than in any city in the United States, because at least there they had medical care. Publicizing this report shamed the government into taking action. What a miracle. It's hard to imagine such a time. But the government saw this report, they received public pressure, and they then decided to provide money to address the problem. When this new funding became available, there was a gathering, a coming together of badass community activists in Pittsburgh. I imagine this motley crew forming like an Avengers movie, with each superhero coming in with their particular power. First, there was the community organizer named Phil Halen, who ran a civil rights organization in Pittsburgh focused on healthcare. He connected with a jobs training program called Freedom House, run by local African American men who had been delivering healthy food to folks in their neighborhood, in a place where it was otherwise hard to get good food and fresh vegetables. And then Phil brought in a local doctor that he found, someone who was particularly interested in this problem of emergency medicine. Together, the team formed the Freedom House Medics, who became the first emergency medical service in the country to be staffed by people with actual medical training. The Freedom House Medics signed a contract with the city of Pittsburgh as the first civilian paramedics, and they saved 200 lives in their first year of operations. The model of the Freedom House Medics was then replicated all across the country. If you've ever seen an ambulance staffed by someone with medical training, it's thanks to the Freedom House Medics. They have saved countless lives since then, and they changed our very understanding of healthcare, of who should get taken care of, who deserves that. Together, this team created a new kind of job. They created a jobs training program for African Americans in Pittsburgh who had been systematically kept out of other career opportunities, and they created a whole new branch of medicine. But because all of the first paramedics, nearly all of them, were African American men, the police fought them every step of the way. The police regularly tried to keep the paramedics from providing medical care in emergency situations. And in a number of cases, that meant leaving injured people on the side of the road while the police blocked access for the ambulances. The Freedom House Medics persevered, though, and in spite of the police harassment, Pittsburgh had defunded the police, at least in this way. The city of Pittsburgh, and then nearly every city since, took away a significant part of their job and gave it to more qualified people. Pittsburgh and every other city in our country has been healthier and safer ever since. The Freedom House Medics taught us many things. Number one, they remind us what James Baldwin said, that nothing is fixed, that change is possible. The earth is always shifting, the light is always changing. Second, they remind us that collective problems, systemic problems, require collective solutions, systemic solutions, which means that every single one of us has a role to play. In this case, I love that it was the nerdy government bureaucrats, bless them, who wrote the reports and then approved the funding. It was the Freedom House team delivering groceries who knew the needs of their neighbors and knew the layouts of their streets and neighborhoods. It was the doctor with the technical skills, and it was the community organizer who brought them all together to do together what none of them could have done alone. And third, they remind us that everyone has a role to play, and everyone's role is made more meaningful when we do it in collaboration together. They cast their lot together, and with no extraordinary power, they reconstituted some piece of this broken world. As Asani reminded us, each of us are tied to community and tied to struggle. So, beloveds, let's remember these stories. Let's remember our history as we imagine new futures and new possibilities ahead. Let us continue to ask ourselves how we will care for each other. Because when we speak of systemic racism, it's to say that racism isn't just about personal prejudices. It is built into those systems and institutions that shape our lives. It's the reason that roads and highways and public transit are placed where they are or not. It's the reason why our public schools are funded with local property taxes, which are based in segregated wealth. It's why our country has a weak inheritance tax, because when we ended legal segregation, we didn't want to end the wealth inequality that was created by it, and we wanted to ensure that that wealth inequality was passed on to future generations. It's why we still, so many years later, are still debating about who gets a vote and who gets a voice in our elections. Dr. King knew this. He spoke of this saying, "Whenever the government provides opportunities and privileges for white people and rich people, they call it subsidies. When they do it for the Negro and poor people, they call it welfare." The fact is that everybody in this country is on welfare. The problem is that we all too often have socialism for the rich and rugged free enterprise capitalism for the poor. That's the problem. I've seen this in my own life. A housemate of mine a few years ago was an asylum seeker from Mexico where he had faced abuse and torture, and he fled to seek asylum in the United States. But the process for seeking asylum, easier at the time, was that the first step was to go immediately to jail and to wait for your paperwork to go through. What other government benefit works like this? My spouse reminded me that as someone who owns her home, she's entitled to a mortgage tax deduction. And every year she gets that deduction. She doesn't even have to apply for it. And if she did, she would not have to go to jail to wait for the paperwork to go through. This is what we mean by socialism for the wealthy and rugged free enterprise capitalism for the poor. The poorer you are, or the more your community is a community of color, the harder the paperwork, the higher the fines, the higher the bar for the applications, the longer you wait in jail for your application to go through. This is the depth of racism in our country still. But we know nothing is fixed. Let me tell you another story. This one about firefighters. In the early days of the United States, no one saw it as the government's job to fund firefighters. So the first volunteer firefighting brigades formed to meet this need. But in many cities, they were a lot like a private insurance company. If you paid them, they would fight a fire at your house. But if you didn't pay, if you weren't a subscriber, they would watch it burn. It got worse from there, though. In some cases, the brigades worked more like a mix of violent street games and ethnic fraternal orders. They formed together around bonds of race and class, and they fought each other for territory and market share. A book called How the Irish Became White describes the situation this way. With firefighting as a pretext, the private brigades fought continuously over control of territory and extorted money from homeowners who had good reason to anticipate a fire if they failed to pay. Arson was high on their list of weapons, and one of their favorite tactics was to set a fire near the territory of a rival company and then lie in wait to attack them when they showed up. A report in 1853 said, quote, "There is scarcely a single case of riot brought before the courts that has not its origin in the fire companies." Can we just take a moment to imagine this scene, by the way? You are in your home and you look out your window and you see that your neighbor's house is on fire. And one gang of firefighters, the ones that started the fire, are there beating the heck out of another gang of volunteer firefighters in order to get more territory and more money and more opportunity for exploitation from them. And your first thought is, oh no, not again. For some time, though, this was the best we could do. For some time, this was the best answer our society could come up with for the question of how do we care for each other when our neighbor's home is burning. For some time, no one could imagine a better way. This was the violence of privatized fire brigades before we imagined a whole new way of organizing ourselves. You'll notice, by the way, that in all of the polarized political debates over government regulation, no one ever quite suggests that we reprivatize firefighters back to the racialized mob violence of the past. Most people, for a while, though, assumed the earth was fixed. They assumed that change wasn't possible. So the best one could hope for was to win at this game of corruption rather than change the rules of the game. It's easy to laugh at the naivete of our forefathers, and I use the gendered language there on purpose. But I believe someday our grandchildren will tell the story of a time when wildfires ran rampant over our communities, while the privatized fossil fuel companies who caused the fires also went unregulated. And political leaders shrugged their shoulders and said how much they wished there was something to be done about such unspeakable violence. Perhaps our grandchildren will also be able to tell a story of how eventually the people came together to address the emergencies that faced them and learn to put out the fires and put an end to the economies of violence that created them. Beloveds, let's remember this history as we imagine new futures. So what does all this have to do with our purpose here? At the time of the firefighting gangs, there was perhaps a similar divide opening up in religion. At a time when mainstream Christianity had declared a false binary between the saved and the damned, between those bound for heaven and those destined for hell, our Universalist ancestors imagined a new possibility. They responded with the belief, the heretical belief, that nobody was unredeemable and that no one was getting left behind, wounded on the side of the road. They said that no one was saved until we were all saved. They believed in a love unordinary. And later on, when humanism converged with universalism, we ended up with, I think, an even higher standard. One that says we shouldn't wait for the next life for salvation, that we can work to save each other here in this life. A belief that said we shouldn't wait until we get to the hospital or the funeral home to start treatment. We can start taking care of each other right away. I believe that the trajectory of humankind is a painfully slow process to stop fighting each other while our neighbors' homes are burning, and instead learning to put out the fires that are plaguing our people. Adrian Rich said that my heart is moved by all I cannot save. I have to cast my lot with those who, with no extraordinary power, reconstitute the world. I love that Rich begins by acknowledging the limits of individualism, all that I cannot save. But by casting our lot with others, nothing less than the world is reconstituted. Friends, there was a time when a heart attack meant calling the police and praying for unlikely help from unqualified people before we imagined new ways of caring for each other. There was a time when fighting house fires was only for those who could afford privatized insurance in shady deals with racist gangs, before we imagined that safety for one was safety for all. There was a time, still today, when we have socialism for the rich and rugged free enterprise capitalism for the poor. And there was a time, still today, when we have prisons for some and public education for others. A more universalist world means imagining better answers to the question of how we will care for each other. It means finding collective solutions to collective problems, coming together to do together what none of us could do alone. It means that everyone, every single person, has a role to play, and that everyone's role is made more meaningful when we do it in collaboration together. That we are each tied to community as well as to struggle, and each of those makes the other stronger. It means that imagining a new world is a possibility we can do together in community, that we can create a vision wider than any of us has alone, and we can create change beyond the work of any one of us. We can create a change with the love of our hearts and with the work of our hands. We can ensure everyone has a voice and everyone has a vote and no one is left behind on the side of the road. Beloveds, may it be so, and may we make it so together. Amen.
So good to be with you all. I want to say a special hello to my folks online, my community online there. Hello. I'm in person today. And also a big hello to my family that's watching, my mom, my sister, and my aunt. You know, my mother visited me and my partner in our home in Portland, Oregon recently. On a bright and warm, sunny afternoon, sitting on the patio, my mom and I reminisced about her life in particular. And on those easy summer afternoons, those chats with my mom revealed that community, interconnectedness, and the long foray for change are hallmarks of a people, my family, who at every moment struggled for justice and a better life for themselves and future generations. But they didn't do this alone. My family story is, yes, one of justice and a better life, but also unmistakably community too. My mom grew up in Lawnside, New Jersey, a town that was established in 1840 and incorporated in 1926 as the first independent, self-governing Black municipality north of the Mason-Dixon line. First founded by abolitionists, Lawnside was an important site in the Underground Railroad, offering refuge for enslaved Blacks who were fleeing slavery, and about exit 44 off the Garden State Parkway, if that matters to you. But my grandmother and grandfather first arrived in Philadelphia well before my mother's birth in 1948, as they fled their hometowns in Florida, escaping the terrors of the Jim Crow South. You may know that Philadelphia was one of the cities that was part of the Great Migration. The Great Migration was a mass movement of African Americans from the rural South to industrial cities of the North, the Midwest, and West between 1916 and 1970. They were escaping racial violence, Jim Crow laws, and limited education and economic opportunities in the South. My grandmother only had a sixth grade education. My grandfather could only find menial hard labor. And so 6 million Black Americans, including my grandparents, migrated in search of better jobs, education, and a chance to build a new life. After spending a few years in Philadelphia as a young couple, they're about 35 or so, my grandparents moved across the Delaware River to Lawnside, New Jersey, the all-Black town with a good reputation, opportunity, and safety for their then 6 children, later to become 8 with my mother being the baby of those. And it was there that my mother and her 7 older siblings grew up, in a town where, as my mother describes it, everyone was Black, from the man who delivered milk to your home, to the family dentist, the accountant, physician, teacher. My mother grew up with representation all around her, surrounded by Blackness. And it was in that context that my mom believed that she had the right to all parts of the American dream. Can you imagine? I mean, what a contrast for my grandparents, and unknowingly for my mom and her siblings. In the first part of my family story, the rural South, where racialized violence, poverty, and trauma were everyday experiences. And then the all-Black town founded by abolitionists for the next part of our story, where my family had access to dignity, safety, and their dreams. Yes, threaded through all the story of my family is community, the struggle for justice, and working together to make change. A story that began in 1840, 185 years ago, when Black and white abolitionists struggled together in community to establish a town that was a safe haven for Blacks, a home for my grandparents, aunts, uncles, my mother. So what's possible when we contribute in small and large ways to a long struggle for justice? And when we do that with and surrounded by community, we can, like my grandparents, find a home in the community of our dreams. We can take the sixth grade education of my grandmother and transform it into master's degrees for my mom and aunts in one generation, and a PhD and medical degree for my sister and I in 2 generations. We are all, each of us, tied to community and to struggle in those communities. Our choices today will impact future generations. So what's your lasting story? What will be your contribution?